wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down.
Et bonjour, mes amis. Bonjour, citoyens. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. I'm Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer. And you, if you had been alive and active and in Paris 150 years ago today, you would have been not an old mole, but a citoyen, a citizen. This is the 150th anniversary of the Paris Commune. Let's celebrate it together. And we shall do so momentarily. But if this isn't too slick of a segue, I want to remind you to celebrate KBOO's spring membership drive. Only a small proportion of our listeners are actually donors or members, which means two things: that this station reaches a wide audience, and that it needs support to continue to be an important part of this community that it is. If you're able, please become a monthly sustaining member, or at least make a one-time donation. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or send a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Today's Old Mole is a true variety hour. We have four different pieces, two riddles, and maybe one question for you. Let's begin with the first of the riddles. Why did Lenin dance in the snow on the 73rd day of the Russian Revolution? Got that? Why did Lenin dance in the snow on the 73rd day of the Russian Revolution? I'll bet there aren't more than five of you out there who know the answer without looking it up. Don't look it up. Keep listening. I'll give you the answer as the show goes on. Before then, we'll have Sharon Grant in a lively interview with Kitty Martz. Kitty's a peer mentor with Voices for Problem Gambling Recovery. Sharon's done some powerful readings for the Old Mole. Now, in an interview, she asks whether we really want the Oregon Lottery to expand gambling in our state. Bill Resnick will talk with Elizabeth Thiel, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, about reopening the schools, of course, but also about the union's vision for what public education can and should be. Following Bill, we'll have another episode in our continuing series, Another World is Possible. Today, as I mentioned, we celebrate the sesquicentennial, the 150th anniversary of the Paris Commune. If there's any single historical event that's inspired dreaming, strategic thinking, and action toward building the much better world that's possible, it's the Paris Commune of 1871. I'll say more about the Commune and the inspiration it provided later in the program. Meanwhile, here's the second riddle I promised. Why is the music associated with this extraordinary uprising so seemingly lacking in militancy? For an anthem of a revolution, the music is about cherry blossoms? I'll play some of it for you later and see what you think. Oh, and the one question I know you're dying to ask. Since we're focused on French revolutionary themes, whatever became of the guillotine? Is it in storage? Stay tuned for the answer. Finally, we'll revisit one of our favorite guests, Kaya Sand, who talks about writing poetry with a sledgehammer and about the illegal files the Portland police have kept on political activists. You may be amazed at the connection between poetry and the police red squads. Since that 2014 conversation, Kaya has become executive director of Street Roots, advocacy organization for the houseless, which also produces the important street newspaper I hope you support. Now, here is Sharon Grant with Kitty Martz.
This is Sharon Grant with the Old Mole Variety Hour. My guest is Kitty Martz. You run a peer support program for Voices of Problem Gambling Recovery. So the word peer means that you had a gambling problem and now you're supporting others to get better, right?
That's right, Sharon. I'm one of the 2.6% of Oregon adults who got addicted to gambling. Actually, most of us to the video slot machines that are run by the Oregon Lottery.
And I have to say, I actually know you pretty well, and you have never come across to me as someone who's weak-willed. So how did you develop a gambling problem?
Well, thanks. Those responsible gambling tools weren't effective for folks like me. I was already struggling with things like other addictions. So toddling down the street and pushing a button that like dosed me with dopamine was frankly something I needed at the time. Now, however, the lottery is under pressure to modernize and introduce these Vegas-style slot machines on handheld devices, and those could be used from home.
I know that the lottery lets you gamble on that scoreboard sports app on phones already, which proves that they can pretty much do whatever they want without legislative or public consent. So the state is already in the handheld bookie business.
I know, right? And my gambling counselor friends are still just a little bit baffled on how to treat this new handheld addiction thing that you can do 24/7 in isolation, secretly from your family and loved ones. Maybe while you're intoxicated or, I don't know, suffering from dementia or symptoms of a severe and persistent mental illness.
The lottery, quote unquote, does good things, right?
It does. It does. The money, the revenue from the lottery goes to things like economic development, schools and parks. Other states who don't have robust lotteries also have, guess what, economic development, schools and parks. So, yeah.
So why does Oregon have this desperate need for our gambling money?
We don't have sales tax here, and we don't seem to want to anytime soon. Back in 1984, we all voted to have a lottery. Basically, we were probably thinking something like dollar Powerball or scratch-it tickets. The lottery's mission is to make as much revenue as they can, commensurate with public good. You and me, we're part of the public. I mean, I don't know if you're an older adult, a person of color, someone who grew up with adverse childhood experiences.
Yep, and yep for me. Yep.
Yeah, so, or has co-occurring health or addiction challenges like me? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there were times when I had to go to a food bank or I couldn't buy my meds, and I'm 68 years old. I don't need this to be happening in my life. People get homeless on these lottery machines.
Right? And these are government-operated machines. This is not private enterprise. They're taking money from folks who are already facing challenges like we were, who get addicted, and that's just a regressive tax. Every other normalized vice that has legit evidence of being highly addictive, your tobacco, your alcohol, your THC, yes, marijuana is addictive. The state, they regulate it. They tax it. Not gambling. With gambling, the state's like, mine.
So are we going to have slot machines on our phones or not?
Absolutely. We do. That horse has literally left the barn. We have slot machines on our phones now. The question is, are we going to have the Oregon Lottery put publicly operated slot machines on our phones?
So how is that going in the UK, where they have handheld slot machines?
60% of their revenue from those come from only 5% of the players. So when our lottery says they want a lot of people to play a little, well, then they probably shouldn't have handheld devices, because that's not what happens with those. Also, those handheld devices in the UK have a 9.2% addiction rate, which, yikes. However, they also have pretty strict laws to protect their players. They don't just put up signs to gamble responsibly. They display on the screen how much you lost, how long you played. They can't give you the illusion of control in the outcome or disguise your losses as actual wins. Those are predatory practices. Do you recognize any of these tricks from playing machines?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So do you reckon operators like the lottery, if it's up to them, are going to voluntarily put those kind of safety measures in place for the public good?
Well, they haven't so far, so.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a big fan of Oregon Lottery slot machines, but at least you have to get yourself to a brick and mortar venue that has set hours. Maybe they have employees trained and being able to offer some kind of support, like the 1-877 My Limit number, where you can get free counseling for gambling. You have to be able to function in public.
So what's the plan? Where are we at to stop this if we're concerned about it? What do you think will happen?
Bipartisan Bill HB 3078 is in committee. It would prevent the lottery from putting slot machines on our phones. I think best possible scenario will get a reprieve for a year or two, like a moratorium on handheld functions while maybe they get some expert guidance. Hey, you know, a push is better than a pull.
So what can people do if they are concerned about this?
You can let Governor Brown or Speaker Kotek know your thoughts on HB 3078 sooner than later, like today. Let them know if you think it's appropriate to have publicly run high-speed gambling on our phones, or whether you think the lottery has surpassed its intended reach.
I really appreciate your time, Kitty. What else do you have to say as we end?
Oh, thank you, Sharon. I guess just that if you or your loved one are struggling with gambling, there is hope. We're living proof of that, and there's free help here in Oregon. Please call 1-877-MY-LIMIT. If you want to contact me or learn about peer support services, visit vpgr.net or call 503-486-7377.
This has been Sharon Grant of the Old Mole Variety Hour with Kitty Martz, advocate of House Bill 3078.
Thank you, Sharon and Kitty. Elizabeth Thiel is the president of the Portland Association of Teachers. She's been in the forefront of representing teachers' concerns about going back into the classroom in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. Even amidst all that controversy, she's seen an opportunity to talk about what quality public school education could be and how the union can play a role in making it happen. Here's Bill Resnick with Elizabeth Thiel.
Hi, Elizabeth Thiel, now president of the Portland Association of Teachers. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
This Old Mole Show first interviewed Elizabeth when she taught English at Portland's Madison High School and was one of the many Portland teachers who had developed engaging, participatory, nurturing teaching methods. This progressive version of teaching owes much to the methods of Paulo Freire in his classic book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. It's one of the many radically reconstructed societal institutions like schools or the workplace, like the workplace and worker co-ops, progressive schools. They demonstrate that another really better world is possible and necessary. Through her 17 years of teaching, she served as a building organizer at Madison and also served on the union board and committees. In 2016, she was elected union vice president, and 2020 became the president-elect. In this country's COVID period, Elizabeth Thiel was involved in working with her children's teachers to combine homeschooling with distant learning. She was also leading Portland teachers and, for one, rallying teachers to do the best possible job in often disappointing distance learning, and second, leading the union and Portland teachers with all of the active teachers, and there were many of them. This is not the Elizabeth Thiel show, it's the union activist show, in developing with the district administration a good plan for reopening to welcome back students and also to keep the schools safe for teachers, parents, and all the people students live among and with. So, Elizabeth, tell us about your hectic years as union president.
Thanks. Yes. As you said, I was elected president of PAT last spring with my term starting in July. So I've only been president so far during a global pandemic. It has definitely been quite a challenging year. And one of the biggest pieces of this year has been working on an MOU with the district around a safe return to in-person instruction.
MOU is a memorandum of understanding.
Yes, it's a legal agreement that's just for this year, the ongoing pandemic, of how we run our public schools so that they're safe and equitable for our students as well as for educators. And it has been one of our greatest concerns to make sure that when we do bring students into our schools in person during this ongoing pandemic, that our schools are as safe and as equitable as they can be. And for safety, what we're most concerned with is that COVID is not spreading among students and certainly not bringing the virus home to students' families. So we have an agreement that is now ratified and in effect. And some of the biggest pieces of it that we worked very hard to make sure were included in the agreement. One of them is around ventilation. We've known for a long time that COVID is airborne. It's spread through the air. So one of the most important factors has been getting good ventilation and clean air into all of our classrooms. And that's also one of the most expensive. Our school buildings, many of them are 100 years old and have very old and under-maintained ventilation systems. So one thing we were able to get is HEPA air purifiers into every place where educators work with students, including counselors' offices and libraries and definitely all of our classrooms. We also have safety committees that meet in every building and have a checklist that maintain that if the agreed upon pieces are not met, that those spaces will not be used for instruction. And so that's really important that there's ongoing monitoring that our learning spaces are safe. We have in our MOU, 6 feet of social distancing, which is what has been recommended throughout this pandemic to make sure that there is less chance of the virus spreading from person to person. And so our classrooms are all set up now for live instruction with students having at least 6 feet in all directions to minimize person-to-person spread. And I just want to acknowledge, like, we have all these things in place in order to do everything that we can. I think we have really strong language to mitigate the spread of COVID, but that does not mean that we are not in a pandemic or that there's no risk, right? We are still in a situation where COVID is spreading in our community. And the biggest value of our educators through all of this is to make sure that our schools are a place where students, if we're meeting live, that it's not putting students or students' families at risk. And so we have done everything we can to get the strongest safety measures into our schools.
You know, that sounds very exciting to me. One of the major goals of the labor movement for the last 30, 40 years is to have union safety committees at every job who have the capacity mm-hmm. to shut down the line or, in fact, go on strike if, in fact, noise levels, pollution levels, heat levels go beyond a certain limit. Now, they haven't won it, but, in fact, in the schools, the Portland Teachers Union apparently has over 100 schools. You have safety committees with real power. That's quite an amazing development, actually, and it bodes well for the union. You have a lot more people involved. Is there anything else you wanted to say on the issue of the reopening?
I think it's important for people to know. One of the factors here is that the governor made an executive order that school districts needed to open all of our elementary, middle, and high school for live in-person instruction in April, and she gave specific dates, ready or not. So it has definitely been a big stress on educators. We were given an arbitrary deadline to have schools ready for students to be in person, and we have worked incredibly hard throughout the pandemic to meet students' needs during these conditions that we would never have chosen. And now that we are opening schools for in-person instruction, we just take it so seriously to make sure that students are safe. And right now, when the governor made that order, the COVID case count in Oregon and Multnomah County was going down. But in the last few weeks, it has gone drastically upward. And so there is a lot of concern that we remember we are not done with this pandemic quite yet. And there are still lots of folks who are not vaccinated. And so we've got to stay vigilant and make sure we get out of this situation all the way before we lower our guards.
Yeah, schools are open now, pre-K to 5, and high school's open, I guess, on April 19th, you told me, hybrid learning. What's the percentage of parents that have decided to send the kid back for hybrid learning?
I don't know that I have an exact number. I know that it's pretty different from school to school. Portland Public Schools has over 90 school sites. You know, we're a big district, and not all schools have a similar breakdown of who's coming back and who is not. And so that's been one of the huge logistical hurdles, is to figure out how to reconfigure all of our schools. Every school is still offering comprehensive distance learning for students who want to continue only remotely, and also offering in-person instruction for students who have chosen that. And some of our schools have the majority of kids who want to be in person for part of the week, and some of the schools have very few students who want that. Every school had to make a plan that works for the choices that families have made.
This is Cable Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, live stream to the universe, the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here talking to Elizabeth Teal, the president of the Portland Association of Teachers, about the school reopening and the teacher and union effort to do it safely and well. So, Elizabeth, the COVID period and the reopening of schools can be seen as a great experiment, actually, in schooling and educating children. Because over the years, the tech companies and their owners, the boy geniuses, as they've been derisively referred to, they've urged society to reimagine schools for the modern age. That the latest technology, of course, that we buy from them, allows online learning with lessons and interactive lessons on the computer. And these can replace inefficient, money-wasting classrooms, as well as those greedy teachers in many areas. All we really need are people to proctor the high-stakes tests that we offer so we can sort out people. I've given away my biases on that issue. After this period of online teaching, we have a lot more knowledge to evaluate these claims. Tell us, how has computer learning worked out here? And I know you've examined some of the literature from around the country.
Well, a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, during remote learning, teachers have continued to be actually interacting with kids, right? So it's not just plug into an app and do a pre-designed activity. Educators this year have been meeting with their students online and talking to them and interacting with them and designing learning to meet the needs of their actual kids, which is very different than that model of sort of plug them into an app and have the app teach them. And even with that, I think one thing that has been so clear during this whole year of distance learning is there's been a lot of urgency to get students back into live classrooms, because I think it is universally acknowledged that learning through a computer does not provide for all of the needs of a student. We've always known that, but there has been such an outcry and urgency to get students back into the classrooms because of the huge value of having those in-person interactions, getting to work with other people, getting to collaborate in groups and do hands-on learning. And even with the interaction from teachers in the remote learning we've done throughout this year, we know that there is nothing that takes the place of learning that is built on relationships and the specific interests of students.
Yeah, I remember my Mr. Schneller, an English teacher that I had, he was very important to me in my life because he was extremely supportive when I really, really needed it. I think being nurturant and trying to help kids deal with adolescent problems and earlier is really important. One useful impact, though, of distance learning seems to me that the teachers and parents also talk to each other much more. The parents who try to help their kids in the home and urge them to do their homework and all the rest of it, many of the parents also talk to the teachers. Have you found that to be the case, that parents now appreciate the schools much more, appreciate the art and skills and imagination? What have you found with regard to that in this current period?
You know, well, I definitely have heard lots of folks talking this pandemic about getting to see what it takes to go through a school day to keep kids engaged. It is a huge challenge to keep one student engaged in challenging learning activities. And of course, lots of parents across the country have seen what that looks like and what an amazing skill it takes to keep 20 or 30 kids engaged in learning at the same time throughout the day. So I think there's definitely been a lot of opportunities for families to see their kids' education in a way that hasn't been possible before. But I think it's been the case, and it continues to be the case, that, you know, parents tend to be very favorable towards their kids' teachers, even when they're frustrated with the school system, like they may be this year with distance learning. It's not what anyone would have chosen. It's been the safest way to continue to educate students in a global pandemic. But this year, teachers have had to redefine and reinvent their whole practice to figure out how to continue to engage kids and provide meaningful learning in the absence of so many tools that we typically use. And to make that happen, there's been an incredible amount of collaboration and mutual support from teacher to teacher to share what's working and to share materials that you can use through a computer screen and to share activities to keep kids motivated and engaged. Educators have put in an incredible amount of work and creativity to make this work this year.
This is your Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM Portland. The Old Mole explores the struggle by working people, the great majority, to create an egalitarian, caring, democratic, sustainable society. I'm Bill Resnick today talking to Elizabeth Teal, new president of the Portland Association of Teachers. 17 years teaching, a union activist, became vice president, now president of the Portland Teachers Union, helping the union navigate this COVID period. We've been talking about the union role and the challenge to reopening the school system. That was forced into distance learning, to say the least, very difficult. But one thing it did teach and to parents was the value of in-person public education. And I'd like to conclude the interview discussing how ongoing efforts by millions of educators to reconstruct schools from the old disciplinary punitive method, which is what I actually grew up in. They had quiet in the classroom. Every kid was engaged, sort of, producing something on paper. It was extremely intolerant of childhood lack of attention and efforts to be friendly and all of the rest of the things, acting out some of their troubles. Extremely intolerant. But teachers through the centuries actually have made ongoing efforts to build a curriculum that just doesn't teach a bunch of facts, but really engages children in democratically organized classrooms, working together, and nurturing classrooms, making an effort to stop the endemic bullying that sometimes happens in schools. And in some schools, they're very supportive of everybody. Kids are clearly capable of sympathy and empathy for others if they see that in the world and they're asked to value that. So what's happened in the last period, particularly in Portland? I recall in 2014, the contract, it was really a path-breaking contract in an extraordinary situation. The school administration basically collapsed when they tried to break the union, and they agreed to all sorts of provisions in the contract, like the free speech provision, which allowed teachers to deviate from the standard rote curriculums that are sort of favored by lots of educators and businessmen, by some educators appointed by businessmen. That model has always been challenged. Have the teachers in Portland managed to employ those free speech provision to really enrich their curriculum, work together over the years, in fact, with students? How's that happening? Tell us about it.
Yeah,
Elizabeth
Teal. In our contract, we do have language that protects academic freedom for educators to use materials in addition to the ones mandated by the district so that we have the freedom and the ability to match kids' interests, to make learning meaningful, to talk about current events and bring relevancy to learning at all levels. And that has been crucially important to educators at every grade level, from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade, to make sure that we can make learning meaningful and relevant to our students. And you talked about, you know, the past of education, including, you know, large class sizes and students, and a lot of emphasis being put on compliance, right, with students. Because when you have a large group of people in a small space, that becomes a primary method of creating order. And I think that method, as a rule for how public schools should operate, has really shown to not be the right model. It is one of the biggest values of educators is to make sure that we're meeting the needs of all of our students, every single one of our students. And we know that more and more in our inequitable society, students come to school with different needs and different levels of needs. So some of the things that we have been advocating for to make sure that we're able to run schools that are based on meeting students' needs and being relevant and meaningful to students, we know we need smaller class sizes. We know students deserve the attention of an adult, and an adult who has enough time and attention to get to know every kid and see every kid for who they are and what their strengths are and what their challenges are, and to be able to bring things into the classroom that specifically support that student. We know that our schools need more counselors. We need more social workers. You know, we need to have relevant clubs and activities at every one of our schools so that every student has things that they're looking forward to within the school day. Every student has adults who can support them with their specific needs, and that every classroom is designed to honor and support who every student is as an individual. And those things are longstanding needs that we've been fighting for in schools, and they're expensive. It costs a lot to add the adults that our kids deserve and to be able to meet all their needs. And so that's why we are always advocating for adequate school funding and stable school funding so that we can put those things in all of our schools and not have to cut them. Frequently in Oregon, we're in a cycle of deciding which programs to cut from our schools. And what our kids deserve is to have those services and activities and programs permanently and stably funded, and so that we can guarantee that we're going to meet the needs of our students.
Elizabeth Keel, President of the Portland Association of Teachers, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
That was Bill Resnick talking with Elizabeth Thiel of the Portland Association of Teachers. Before we turn to Another World is Possible and the answers to the riddles I posed at the start of the program, I'd like you to think about whether there's any other radio station you know that would engage you with a riddle about Lenin dancing in the snow, or would talk in depth with a union leader about her vision for education, or would invite you to celebrate the revolutionary Paris Commune. This is the spring membership drive for KBOO. Support KBOO and show your support by donating at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Now it's time for AWP, Another World is Possible, and our theme music, We Have the Guillotine. Or is it, We Have the Guillotine? Do they mean that literally? Is that part of the answer to the question I posed you earlier? Whatever became of the guillotine? As we look back at the Paris Commune, is our AWP theme music appropriate, or is it singularly inappropriate? Here it is, performed by The Coup. At the start of today's program, I posed you two riddles. The first, you'll remember, was, why did Lenin dance in the snow on the 73rd day of the Russian Revolution? The snow part is obvious, This was Russia in January. But why dance? And why the 73rd day specifically? The story may be apocryphal, photographic evidence of Lenin dancing anywhere, indoors or out, is rare. But celebrate he did, for on the 73rd day of its existence, the Russian Revolution surpassed the 72 days of the Paris Commune of 1871, the first organized working-class revolution in the West. Today, in the midst of its 150th anniversary, we look back at the Paris Commune, the uprising that defined both anarchism and Marxism, that inspired and changed the lives of great 19th century revolutionaries, that expanded the sense of possibilities for artists, poets, and writers of utopian fiction, and that brought a horrific repression that revealed the authoritarianism behind the bourgeois state and the limited kind of democracy we live under to this day. Which gets us to the second of our riddles. Why the anthem for this working-class revolution is so gentle? During the French Revolution of 80-plus years before, people sang the Marseillaise with its stirring call to arms against the bloody flag of tyranny. Aux armes, citoyens, formez vos bataillons. To arms, citizens, organize your battalions. And it was, after all, a leading participant in the Paris Commune who wrote the militant The International, directed to the wretched of the earth, the enslaved masses. But that was after the Commune had been crushed. During its 72 days, people sang Le temps des cerises, the time of the year when the cherries bloom. It's a song about dreams and love, but also suffering and heartache. I won't attempt a detailed analysis of it here, but will suggest that it reflects a different vision of revolution from those that preceded it. Maybe the tip-off is in the attitude toward the guillotine. Our theme music for Another World is Possible, this segment of The Old Mole, is We Have the Guillotine by The Coup. The French Revolution worked its guillotine overtime. In the Paris Commune, instead, an organized women's group wheeled out the guillotine and burned it. Right or wrong, naive or strategic, cutting off heads was not their vision for how to create a better society. They also, of course, benefited from the fact that their class opponents, the bosses and officials, fled from Paris to Versailles, leaving workers in charge. As we turn to the history, here's just the first stanza of Le temps des cerises, sung by Cora Vauquer.
Nous en serons au temps des cerises, et gay rossignol et merle moqueur seront tous en fête. Les belles auront la folie en tête, et les amoureux du soleil au cœur. Quand nous en serons au temps des cerises, sifflera bien mieux le merle moqueur.
So what then was the Paris Commune, and why was it so viciously suppressed? Here are the words, translated of course, of Élisée Reclus, another leading participant who managed to survive the massacre and live in exile. Here he's testifying to an inquest some 25 years later. His words are worth listening to because they're not just nice words people say they're aspiring to, but his after-the-fact account of the actual on-the-ground efforts of the commune. He said, "The commune set up for the future a more superior ideal to all the revolutions that preceded it, a new society in which there are no masters by birth, title, or wealth, and no slaves by origin, caste, or salary." Everywhere the word commune was understood in the largest sense as referring to a new humanity made up of free and equal companions, oblivious to the existence of old boundaries, helping each other in peace from one end of the world to the other. End quote. So, an abolition of class structures and exploitation, equality between women and men, an end to nationalism, meaning incorporation into citizenship, into membership in the commune, of everyone, no matter where they came from, no borders, an end to conquests and military adventurism. What does that mean for the institution of the state? What of the market? These are themes we'll explore this time and in our next episode of Another World is Possible. There is also an explicit contrast with the French Revolution of those 80-plus years before. That revolution, undoubtedly a step forward historically in so many ways, did use the guillotine, attempted to restore slavery in Haiti, passed legislation restricting workers' rights to organize, and launched military expeditions abroad. The Paris Commune, in important respects, was its antithesis. Its participants also called it the République des Travailleurs, not a bourgeois republic, but the workers' republic. Let's begin with the question of gender. I mentioned that it was women specifically who destroyed the guillotine. Perhaps in another episode, we'll reflect on the role women have played in revolutions and on the imagery of women promoted by different types of revolution. Just as the early 20th century Russian revolutions began with women demanding bread and controls over the price of bread, the Paris Commune began with concerted action by women. On March 18th, 1871, early in the morning, women of the Montmartre district blocked the French army from taking cannons from the hill that is Montmartre. The cannons belonged to the neighborhood. They'd been bought by accumulating small local contributions for the National Guard, which consisted of local men, heavily working class, not part of nor controlled by the army. The army was trying to seize the cannons to take them out of the city, out of local control. Intimidating the army into leaving, the working-class women of Paris precipitated the uprising that became the Paris Commune. Soon after, they organized a union specifically for women, the Union des Femmes, the Women's Union. Among their many accomplishments, a system of daycare located throughout the city near workplaces for working women. They successfully pushed for a prohibition on child labor and contributed to the establishment of free, public, secular, and mandatory education for all children, girls as well as boys. By secular, they meant no longer under the control of the reactionary church with its patriarchal conception of gender roles. And the Women's Union was a force in emphasizing the importance of art and culture in mobilizing for struggle, and even in redefining what's meant by art. Away from the old high culture restricted to elites, they pushed also for recognizing artisanry and craftsmanship by working folks, women as well as men. In the next episode of Another World is Possible, we'll talk more about the Paris Commune, its history, what made it possible, what possibilities it showed, what accomplishments it had, and its legacy. For now, here's another version of that same first stanza of Le Temps des Cerises, this time sung by Jean Lumière.
Quand nous chanterons le temps des cerises, et Rossignol et Merle moqueur seront tous en fête, les belles auront la folie en tête, et les amoureux du soleil au cœur. Quand nous chanterons le temps des cerises, sifflera bien mieux le merle moqueur.
For our final piece, we look to the Old Mole archives. If the city has archives, and the police department does, as you'll learn, so does the Old Mole. Kaya Sand is a creative force in Portland, a poet and artist, as well as current executive director of Street Roots. Here we go back to a 2014 conversation she and I had, prompted by an installation she was part of creating. We've cut the outdated details. Here's Kaya in those long ago days when we could be in the studio together.
And I have here in the studio with me Kaya Sand of the Watcher Files Project. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Kaya.
Thank you, Norm.
I'll do a brief introduction. Okay. I know Kaya from a couple of books of poetry, and that would be Remember to Wave and also Landscapes of Descent with Jules Boykoff, subtitled Guerrilla Poetry and Public Space. Some of the themes in her poetry that I've recognized would be what ties us all together. Ambiguity, another kind of theme, and as you've heard, the importance of public space. But I know Kaya also is a performance artist. So first of all, what's your files project? What are the files?
So these are files, these are police investigation files that are housed at the city archives, and they're also referred to as the Red Squad files, but these are sort of the later decades of the collection of files that are at the archives from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, when police spies basically collected surveillance on activist and civic groups in Portland.
Let's not leave that past tense, of course. I've been here since 1979. And in the Northwest, and we've had three different cycles now where it's exposed one way or another that there's a Red Squad and that it's keeping tabs on political activists unconstitutionally and in violation of Oregon law. And they always say, well, that's in the past and we're not doing it anymore. And then it's exposed again. Mm-hmm. And like I say, three different cycles. So this is one of them earlier. And you remember that it was a really interesting story how these files... How we discovered them?
Yeah, they were discovered in a barn, mildewing away with mice droppings among them, and anonymously donated to the Portland Tribune newspaper. So that's where they were first exposed in a series of articles. And then the city archivists read those articles and championed making these files public. So they're actually, you know, available for anyone to go in and look at.
So it sounds like in the first place, we owe a debt of thanks to Kaya for working her way through mice droppings.
Well, I think the debt of thanks goes to the archivists who actually cleaned them up.
How do you convert files like that into a performance piece?
Well, just to back up a little bit, tonight, Gergi Mantani and I are going to open an exhibit of work, and it comes from a city residency, an artist residency at the archives. So the archivist Diana Banning, who at the city archives had this vision of trying to open up who uses the archives, you know, and I'm sure a number of the listeners use archives, but she wanted to make sure that artists came in and thought about, you know, what to do with these sort of uninterpreted documents. So Garrick and I, for the more than a year, have been working through these city files and thinking about ways that we could make work. And what we ended up coming up with is our poetry and artwork that really, I'd say, runs along two themes. And one of them is commemorating anonymous activist efforts. And the other theme would be maybe the flip of that, and that's thinking about some very specific activist efforts and how to take what was, you know, sort of a, had a kind of an ill intent in terms of the surveillance and flip it around. I kind of think of it as like the phoenix from the ashes. You know, how do we make something out of that? So some of the work comes from actually collaborating with some activists.
That's your thinking behind what you'll be doing. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what to expect.
So if you go to the exhibit tonight or any day between now and December 5th at the North Portland branch of the Multnomah County Library.
On North Killingsworth.
On North Killingsworth, yeah, 512 North Killingsworth. What you can expect to see is artwork that you actually, by and large, can touch and open and interact with. There's a cabinet in there that the drawers open into artwork. Poetry is inscribed on the sides of it. There are bookshelves with more language inscribed on the top of them, but they're full of books that several activists actually curated for us of recommended reading. So it's books that informed their thinking over the years. And there's, there's a drawer of poetry that's pounded into index cards that you could thumb through like you might be doing in the archives.
Pounded in,
sledgehammered in. It's the most fun way to write poetry is with a sledgehammer, I've discovered. And there's...
You heard it here first on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Yeah, a new approach to poetry.
It's the way to make it dangerous, right, at least for the poet. The poet's thumb. Garrick Imatani created the whole cabinet in the shape, actually, of several protest routes that were overlaid, the maps that we found in the files, as a kind of gesture toward what if we could read our whole city in terms of how the ground has been, you know, walked in protest. And of course, you know, we only came across so many protest maps, but he overlaid those and created actually the shape of the cabinet in the shape of several protest marches.
That's really interesting. I occasionally lead tours, like for high school kids or for labor folks who come to town, of historical events or labor history mm-hmm. that's occurred here. And it gives people, especially the high school kids, it gives them a whole new sense of the city, gives them a whole new sense when they realize that events that are significant took place right here where they're used to walking by.
Yeah, I know you and I really hold, I think, that interest in common. And Garrick also holds that interest of sometimes we think about it as how to make visible what's invisible. But sometimes it's just transforming what's invisible into something else that's, you know, not necessarily what was, because that's impossible. But it's some kind of creative effort, at least to salvage and reconstruct in an interesting way.
Things that were important to us, things mm-hmm. that inspired us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. You mentioned that you expect that some of the listeners will be familiar with the archives. My guess is even more of the listeners will find themselves in those files.
Oh. Yeah. Well, if they want to go down to the city archives, it's downtown. Actually, it's on 6th Avenue and Southwest Montgomery, right on the MAX line, the green line. And it's on the 5th floor of the PSU Rec building. So it's open, you know, it has specific reading room hours, but the archivists are very accommodating, so people can go in and, you know, as long as they observe archivist protocol, they can read the
records. No smoking.
And I should say that through this residency, part of it was working with the constraints of working in archives. So we had the same access that anyone else in the city has. So, for instance, one thing that came of that was interesting is that Garrick, you know, wanted to work with photography, but he couldn't just take the photographs and the negatives out of the archives. So he actually very creatively transformed the conference room in the archives into a dark room, and he made prints out of the negatives that were in the archives, right in the archive space.
Who are some of the other collaborators?
So, excuse me, the bookshelves were that we curated with activists were done by Kent Ford, who is a founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party, Lloyd Marbette, who decades of working as a citizen intervener on behalf of the danger of the people in the area in terms of the dangers of nuclear power, Joanne Alexiak, who has really worked on a lot of different issues, but including nuclear munitions and nuclear disarmament. And so just a few of the things that we made with them, with Joanne, Garrick and Joanne created a table that has BBs inside of it that Joanne's going to pour in tonight as part of our opening to account for all the nuclear weapons in the planet. And Joanne and I actually made these very, very, very small books, inch by inch books, of drawings that she did for activist flyers over the years. And a number of these we found in the files. They're drawings both from, you know, white train actions and other actions around Hanford, but also there was a radical school in the 1980s that some listeners might have been a part of, the Red Rose School, and she did amazing little drawings for that. And actually, as a sort of special takeaway, if you come to the opening, you can have a little book of Joanne's drawings.
This is radio, of course, so you can't see it, but Kaya is simultaneously thumbing through yeah. these tiny little books.
Yeah, just and thanks to Patricia Welch, who's the librarian there, who is a visionary about bringing art into the space, I should say.
Wonderful. This has been Kaya Sand. This is the Watch Your Files Project.
All right. Thank you so much, Norm.
And thanks to our other guests today, Kitty Martz and Elizabeth Thiel, and to Old Mole's Sharon Grant, Bill Resnick, Patricia Kohlberg, John Nelson for his editing, and a special thanks to the KBOO staff, who've kept the station going under these strange and demanding circumstances. 80% of the funding for the station comes from listener memberships and donations. Please demonstrate your appreciation and support during our spring membership drive by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. Or send a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Stay safe and stay active.